Hello, everyone. It's Tom Slater here. We'll get into this episode of Last Orders in just one moment. But before we do that, I just want to remind you all that Last Orders is having its first ever live show. It's going to be at the Battle of Ideas Festival in Westminster on Saturday, the 28th of October. If you've never been to the Battle of Ideas before, it's brilliant. All kinds of fascinating panels with fascinating prominent speakers. Myself and Chris and the Spike crew are regulars there. Our podcast is going to be at 2:45 p.m. on the Saturday, and we'd love to see you there. To get tickets, just go to battleofideas.org.uk. That's battleofideas.org.uk. You can get a ticket for the Saturday. You can get a ticket for the whole weekend. And also, if you're a listener to this podcast or a Spiked reader, you get 20% off. Just use the word Spiked, S-P-I-K-E-D, when you check out to buy your tickets. Thanks so much. And now, on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the ultra-processed food panic, the ban on disposable vapes, and why everyone is getting so fat. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked. Joined, as I am in every episode, by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
And we're delighted to be joined today, returning to the show, Anthony Warner. Anthony is also known as the Angry Chef. He's a chef, he's a writer, he's the author of books including The Angry Chef, The Truth About Fat, and Ending Hunger. And it's great to have him back on the show. Anthony, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So one of the reasons we wanted to have you back on, Anthony, is because since we last spoke to you, the latest sort of food panic has exploded into view. It's something we've been talking a bit about on the podcast in recent months, and that is this thing called ultra-processed food, which, because of a couple of quite popular books, because of a ream of newspaper articles, is now being presented as very much the bogeyman. I'm probably butchering the theory here, but roughly speaking, it's this idea that it's essentially not so much what's in the sausage, but how the sausage is made, which is particularly important, that if something is ultra-processed, if it has all of these E-numbers in it, if it's something that isn't made fresh out of raw ingredients, and even if it's got the same amounts of fat and sugar and whatnot, it's going to be that bit much worse for you. I was just wondering if we want to get into some of the kind of recent news and claims about it specifically, but just in general, what have you made of this phenomenon of ultra-processed food and the panic around it?
Yeah, I mean, it's really not been that surprising to me because it's kind of just the latest food fad, which follows the same pattern as so many others have done in the past. You know, I write about these things. I'm interested in the stuff that we get wrong and the reasons why we fall for fads. And one of the main sort of drivers of all of them is that they offer a simple solution to a complex problem. They offer a simple way of categorizing all foods into good or bad. And that's what we seem to desperately want to do. It's a really unhelpful thing to do if you want to direct people towards healthier diets. But people are really drawn to that sort of idea that you can categorize every food as good and bad and direct your eating around that. The whole ideology and the whole sort of methodology of trying to classify foods in that way is deeply flawed, slightly dangerously flawed, in my opinion, and I'm sure we'll get into that. But it's just like clean eating or the low carb fads. You know, it's a way of classifying food, which kind of is attractive to people and is good if you want to sell something. If you want to sell a book, or you want to sell a health tracking app, or you want to sell a podcast or an article, it's a really appealing way of describing food. But it's not a helpful one, in my opinion.
And what do you make of this, I suppose, the specific claims that are made around it? There's this one randomized control trial from about 5 or 6 years ago, which seemed to suggest that if you gave two groups of people food that has exactly the same amount of calories, allegedly is exactly as appealing to the two groups, I'm not sure exactly how you measure that, that they're going to eat so much more of the UPF. I think in that situation, it's 500 calories more a day or something, put on loads of weight. So generally speaking, I suppose the claim is that people can and want to consume more of it, and therefore they gain more weight. Is that something that you think there's anything to, or, you know, what do you make of this, I suppose, the claims made on the other side of this debate?
It's a decent bit of science. That one randomized control trial, there's a lot of terrible science in UPF. That control trial was well conducted. It's by a serious scientist, by Kevin Hall, who's a serious scientist. And it showed something interesting for me. It showed me that, you know, when we match food in terms of, you know, fiber, protein, carbohydrates and fats, which is the way we usually think about sort of how healthy something is, that there are differences that aren't teased out by those sort of categorizations, by that sort of measuring of the macronutrients. And I think that's important. I think that's interesting. But I don't think the trial shows us that ultra-processed food is dangerous or more palatable. It shows us that one arm of the trial, which was fed the ultra-processed diet, had something about it which drove excess calorie consumption, considerably excess calorie consumption. There's a massive difference. And for me, that's not processing. It's more, you know, there's other stuff you can look at, and it's slightly complex when you start sort of breaking it apart. But the main thing for me that it wasn't controlled for was something that you call eating rate. You know, you'd be comparing a macaroni cheese with a sort of a quinoa and roast vegetable salad or whatever. And they matched from macronutrients, but you know, I think we all understand if you eat the macaroni cheese, you'd eat it faster. You'd consume more calories per minute when you're eating that than you would if you're eating the quinoa salad. And the other thing between those two, which is really interesting, if you look at the meal design in that particular trial, was fiber was very difficult to match. It was very easy to match macronutrients, but it was difficult to match fiber. So on the ultra-processed, ultra-processed foods, as a rule, will have less fiber in because, you know, many of them don't contain much fiber. And so what they did was, because it was difficult to match the fiber, they put a soluble fiber into a drink. So the two arms were matched in terms of macronutrients. And you know, that's very different in terms of palatability to the soluble fiber in a bit of broccoli or in an aubergine or in some whole wheat pasta or something. And it just creates a different eating experience. You eat the ultra processed faster. What they didn't do, and what they should have done, in my opinion, is as they employed someone like me who's a development chef. And so when they had an ultra processed macaroni cheese, they should have made a kitchen-made macaroni cheese, exactly the same, which is a similar sort of thing, because they're just completely different diets that people were being asked to eat. So I think it told us something interesting, but it didn't, for me, tell us that ultra-processing has some sort of mysterious quality that makes you unhealthy.
Mm-hmm. So, Chris, should we talk a bit about the more recent claims that have been made? Because we've been talking a lot recently about UPF being really addictive, that people are gorging themselves on it because it's so soft and delicious and they lose control of themselves. But recently there's been claims made that particular emulsifiers, E-numbers, are actually linked to things like heart disease and so on. Do you want to say a little bit about that and what's been reported recently?
Yes, I saw one yesterday that said that ultra-processed food causes depression in women. Did you see that one, Anthony?
Yeah.
It turned out to be even less impressive than it sounds, or in a way it's, you know, dafter than it sounds, in that actually it was the artificially sweetened drinks that were associated with depression, but not artificially sweetened foods and not actually ultra-processed food in general, which kind of goes to Anthony's point, which is that you're actually making the research into this more crude by creating this enormous category and then trying to work out what part of it is causing the supposed damage. And that is also true of the emulsifiers. So obviously the really big question with this is, clearly, not everything involved in food processing causes cancer and makes people obese. That is, to almost anybody, I think, absurd. Therefore, there must be something in the food processing system, you know, stuff that factories do that people in kitchens don't do that causes a problem. And Van Tulik and other people have pointed to emulsifiers, and they're given some pretty shaky reasons why they think that emulsifiers might cause a problem. And there's dozens and dozens of emulsifiers anyway, right? So even if one of them is bad for you in some way, it's quite unlikely that all of them are.
It's worth pointing out as well that emulsifiers are not limited to processed food either. You know, there's loads of emulsifiers in an egg. There's loads of emulsifiers in seeds. You know, so they're things that occur naturally. So it's not only like emulsifiers are bad. Emulsifiers are only bad when they're put into the processed food. They're not bad when you eat them from natural sources. But we make emulsifiers in our body as well. So we actually create our own emulsifiers. So, you know, it's more than just the you know, I think it's worth pointing that out, because, you know, why is it different? I think you get more in and one egg than you would generally from other ultra-processed foods, even if you're at quite a high level, because you don't put that much in foods when you're making them.
Right. I mean, that's a good point, an interesting one as well. But now everything, because ultra-processed food is big, the big talking point, you get all these studies that try and make out they're about ultra-processed food and actually they're about something else like that, artificially sweetened one. Or in the case of one that came out a week or two ago, the headlines are all about emulsifiers, but actually it just looked at ultra-processed food, really. And they kind of inferred from the fact that they were looking at lots of ultra-processed food that people were eating more emulsifiers, but of course they're eating lots of other things too. And importantly, and this is something that often gets overlooked, if you're eating more of something, you're eating less of something else, right? So it could also equally be a deficiency of something. So this is why nutritional science is a load of rubbish for the most part. And Andy's quite right that randomized control trial was well done. And I think the reason it's, apart from the fact that it's, produced a finding that a lot of people are excited by, the reason it's got so much attention is it's very unusual in nutritional science to do a decent randomized control trial. And there were, even then, quite a few flaws in that study. I had a chat with Kevin Hall, who conducted it, on Twitter a little while ago, and I found out a couple of things that weren't obvious to me from the from reading the study. And it's worth, by the way, if anyone looks at the study, have a look at the appendix where you will see the photos of the food. Right, because they are very, very different. So one question I asked him is exactly what Anthony said then. Why not do an ultra-processed macaroni cheese and have a chef-made macaroni cheese and see if people eat more of that? And he said that was the original intention of the study. They just didn't have the money to do it. Well, let's try and find the money for it, shall we? Because it's not like there's a shortage of money in public health research. It gets squandered on all sorts of things. So that would be a much more interesting study. The other thing I didn't realize, I knew that this was a study in which people could eat as much as they wanted, but I kind of assumed you'd have to go back for a second helping. And he said, no, actually, we gave everybody twice as much food as they really needed, twice as many calories as would be healthy for them. So straight away, in my opinion, you've set it up a little bit to encourage people to overeat. If you had to go back to the counter and get more, perhaps it would be a different story. So a huge amount is being made of one quite small randomized control trial here, and the number of sort of inferences from it, as you've seen with Pantulikan's book, are quite extraordinary. I should just say to any listeners thinking, God, why are you talking about ultra-processed food again? Well, partly obviously because we've got Anthony Warner on, but also because it's quite common to see, stupid and bad policies being proposed. It's quite unusual to see an entirely bad concept just suddenly launched at the public and take hold in double quick time. So for me, doing what I do and writing about what I do, it's quite exciting that something like this has suddenly come along.
Yeah. Can I make a point about emulsifiers? Emulsifiers is the one thing that they're brought out, and Tim Spector's got a thing about emulsifiers, and I'm sure you talked about him before.
People remember him from the pandemic, but he's very much back on his food beat.
Omni grifter, I call him.
and his health tracking app, which I see people now walking around the supermarkets with some little Zoe patches on.
Like a cult. Yeah, that's like a low level cult, yes.
Tagged by Tim Spector.
He talks about emulsifiers a lot. He has this argument about them disrupting the gut microbiome, and that's kind of what people say about emulsifiers. I mean, the one thing important thing to say about it is, if you read most ultra processed food studies, they'll say, what are the mechanisms? Because at least they think about that, which I suppose is fine. But obviously, as Chris said, there can't be one mechanism across all ultra processed food, because that's just, there's no common factor that goes across this such a broad category. So they come to emulsifiers and they say, and we think it might be because of emulsifiers, and because of this, and they'll give one reference to talk about why they think particular emulsifier might be harmful. In terms of approving emulsifiers for food safety, there are committees that sit and go through hundreds and hundreds of references, look at all the research into these emulsifiers, and come to the conclusion that these things are safe for food. And these are committees which are incredibly risk averse. They will, you look at sort of findings on things like acrylamide, which is led to sort of reduction of acrylamide within the food system, and see how risk averse these people are. And they come to the conclusion that there's no potential harm for health. So you've got people saying one study in the paper says that these things are harmful, but you're ignoring all the other data. Many of these things, like methylcellulose, which is which is one which is commonly brought up as being this sort of ultra-harmful thing, because there's a couple of studies in mice that show maybe there's some disruption to the microbiome if you give them loads of it. Methylcellulose, I'm not here to defend it, but there are equally as many studies, probably more, which show it has positive health effects, and it's used as a medicine. It's used as a it's licensed as a medicine with all the testing that involves. The idea that just one study is going to show you that this thing's harmful and we should ban it is absolutely absurd. When you look at the studies that examine the food safety, the most qualified people in the country look at hundreds of bits of research and go, no, well, this is fine, this is safe for human health. And these are not people who like taking risks at all. You know,
you were on Newsnight the other night, weren't you?
Yes.
And I didn't see it. I just saw it. I saw a clip on Twitter. How did it go? Why were they even talking about it?
It was when that sort of poster presentation became sort of national news about ultra processed foods, and it was kind of, you know, wanted someone on. The woman who was on was from Zoe from
the cult. Yeah.
I don't know what they're doing. No, I mean it was fine. I don't think it was my finest moment, but you had minutes to talk about it, and it's a complex subject, and that's the problem. It's difficult to get across to people. They have this like ultra processed food is terrible and it's going to kill you. To explain why they're wrong is actually quite complicated and difficult.
Can't do it in 45 seconds kind of thing. But I saw one of the clips from it, and it was one point I wanted to pick up with you, Anthony, because, and this is something that you've often written about, is the tendency to demonize whole categories of food. And it's often, especially where ultra-processed is concerned, but we've seen this with other food groups as well, which is that it's incredibly class-coded. Like, I was very struck when I was reading the latest Telegraph piece about the latest claims about emulsifiers causing XYZ. And it had this handy kind of list at the bottom of, you eat this, swap it with this. You eat this, swap it with this. And it was just like, you eat this mass-produced sort of food that idiots eat, but you could eat this posh version over here that's much more expensive. You eat Pringles, you have these Piper's crisps, which are handmade by an artisan in the hills or whatever. Or, you know, you should stop having your standard Hovis bread and get this much more expensive artisan sourdough bread. It's so explicit in this particular area. But is that something which is important to comment on, is that we're essentially saying that a lot of food that people who don't have a lot of time to make meals and also don't necessarily have a lot of money are the ones who are being told to have to change their diets in this instance?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's often the case, and it's a weird thing throughout these sort of diet fads that I've written about over the years. It's often the case that cheap, readily available food is the stuff that gets demonized. And I think Chris has made the point. It's hard to design a policy that which sort of plays to your middle class food prejudices, really, and that's what people are trying to do. To the extent that ultra processed food has become, it's actually mutated quite a lot. You know, I don't know if people know it comes from this sort of Brazilian nutrition group, they developed this sort of four stage classification. The worst is ultra processed food. But that's kind of really evolved over time, and now it's become something to do with like the purpose of processing is in there, and I can't think of anything more ideally designed to kind of be able to layer your prejudices onto it and say it's the purpose of processing which is the thing that causes the health harm. When you say it out loud, it just is so ridiculous. You wonder, are people really writing books about this? Are people really believing this? Are people really getting to a point where we might end up with this being put into policy? It is in some countries, actually. Not in the UK, thankfully. I mean, the one thing you would say in the UK, our Scientific Advisory Commission on Nutrition produced a report which said, you know, this is not something we should be basing policy on, and so far we seem to be agreeing with that. It is really telling how, you know, the Gales organic sourdough loaf is the one that the people are recommending, and a standard loaf of bread that most people eat is the one that people are wanting to demonize, because there's this desire to kind of just get people back in the kitchen. Do you know what I mean? Get women back in the kitchen is probably more accurate, to be honest. There's this desire to kind of turn back the clock and get back to a point where everyone was making delicious home-cooked meals, you know, this imaginary point in the past where everyone was making delicious home-cooked meals. It makes me laugh when people say, we should get back to how we were eating, you know, sort of 40, 50 years ago. I think, you know, I was eating 40, 50 years ago and food was terrible. Really, really awful. I mean, yeah, there's so little variety in our diet. Salad was like, you know, I didn't even think about eating salad. You know, there's very few vegetables.
You never hear anyone say there was very low rates of obesity in the 70s. Let's go back to a 70s diet and start having full fat milk and Angel Delight and all this stuff, which I'd be quite happy with, jam, roly-polies, things like that. People weren't fat then. I think there's more to this than meets the eye. You mentioned the middle class thing, reminded me of Edwina Curry's tweet, which I feel I have to read out. So Transport for London banned cheese adverts again. So Edwina Curry tweets about this ban on cheese adverts saying, why? To prevent obesity. But this is artisan cheese. Vintage cheddar, a bit expensive but special, hardly junk food. Does anyone in TFL know the difference? I mean, talk about saying the quiet part out loud, right? This is vintage cheddar and artisan cheese. It's only, you know, it's only your standard, I don't know, normal cheddar, sort of Tesco cheddar should be banned, but artisan cheddar shouldn't, or something.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about cheese is, you know, it's an incredibly processed ingredient. It's incredibly high. I mean, I like cheese. I'm not saying we should do anything like ban it, but it's very high in fat. It's very high calorie density. It's very high in saturated fats. And yet it's not in this ultra processed category. So that's one of the ones that with this sort of categorization system, even cheap cheddar cheese would not be in that category, but kind of the processed cheese slice probably would be. And the definitions are incredibly vague and incredibly strange. And I said they have sort of evolved over time. So, you know, for instance, if I make a lasagna to eat tonight and I use nice fresh ingredients, if I take a stock cube and add that to it, that's ultra processed. So does that make the whole thing ultra processed? I'm not even sure. And I look at this quite a lot. And there is a study from a year or two ago, I think, where 100 or so French nutritionists were asked to categorize foods into these ANOVA classifications. These are people who work in this and people who are interested in these. And none of them agreed. They had also absolute car crash. You know, even the people trained in it could not categorize things into these ANOVA classifications of ultra-processed or minimal processed or whatever they are. And so you think, that's the kind of the basis on which this research is being done, that even the experts can't classify into the right classifications, because when does ANOVA 3 become ANOVA 4, and you know, when does ultra-processed, you know, it's almost impossible to work that out.
My favourite thing about the ANOVA classification is that ANOVA, even though it's always written in capital letters, doesn't actually stand for anything. It looks like it should be an acronym, but it doesn't. It's just a word they picked out. It's completely meaningless. It's kind of a metaphor for the whole thing. It's completely empty and meaningless.
And as you were saying there, Anthony, as well, there's this idea that as if like convenience doesn't count for anything, or that people should just find the time to cut. I think it was the Brazilian scientist who came up with these classifications that says something along the lines of, it's actually quite good to look at a kitchen and see a big bag of sugar. Like, that's fine because people are making their cakes. If you're making your cakes, the cakes are fine. And you say, on the one hand, people might not want to make the cakes. They might not have the time to make the cakes.
But it's saying the quiet part out loud again, isn't it? It's just saying, get back to the kitchen and make your own food. We don't like commercial food products. I mean, there couldn't be much more blatant about it, really.
And I think it's fine to say that if that's your belief, you know, I think that's fine. But
it's not based on anything scientific, is it? It's just a personal prejudice.
Yeah, so a personal prejudice. I think that's actually fine for people to say that. But what you don't do is invent this sort of arbitrary food classification system to kind of do some sort of very suspect epidemiological research to back up your prejudice and say it's based in some sort of, you know, classification. It's just insane. And it's, you know, as I said, it's a nutrition group in Brazil who've just decided we're going to divide all food up into four groups, and we're going to base policy on this one group that we think is particularly bad. You know, this is an obscure nutrition group in Brazil. Are we really going to base policy on how that bloke in Brazil divides our food up and say that 60% of the food you eat is bad and we're going to legislate against it in some way and make it more expensive and less accessible, or whatever it is they want to do?
But he does say, he literally says he wants to ban it. He thinks ultra-processed food should be banned completely. Yeah. He said that on Twitter. This is not somebody I think we should be taking too seriously.
Yeah, and there's no such thing as a healthy ultra-processed food. There's no, you know, he said all sorts of things along those lines. But and then you get these people supporting it. And what I always want to ask them is, you know, what they actually want what they actually want to do. You know, because if you take ultra processed food, for me, the one that the ultimate ultra processed food it would be like a chocolate bar, wouldn't it? Because it's very high in calories, it's very high in fat, it's very palatable. You all know you can eat it very easily. If you want to do an overfeeding study in nutrition science, the one thing that people can overeat to quite a large extent is chocolate. Do you want to ban that? Do you really want to go on television and say, I want to ban Kit Kats? Do you know what I mean? Because or I want to make them three times more expensive. And people sort of shy away from that, and they just sort of say, oh, it's all a whole load of ultra-processed food and it's complicated. But no, I mean, what people are talking about is banning Kit Kats or making them so expensive only rich people can buy them.
Well, you say that, but what's on the cover of Antulikan's book? Wholemeal bread. Yeah, brown wholemeal bread. It's like they're kind of making... They're displaying their Achilles heel almost. Do you know what I mean? They're pulling up the trouser leg and saying, here it is, stab me here.
Or just kind of making people afraid of those foods for some reason that I can't really, you know, do you really want to push people away from those foods? You know, do you really want, because what's the alternative? What are people going to eat?
Sourdough. And then your jaw won't shrink, apparently.
I know some people who work at a university in Holland, and they study this sort of oral processing of food. That's kind of the thing. They're the whole department of people who look at that, and they just got their head in their hands when he's on TV saying, you know, children's jaws have shrunk since 1960 or whatever because they've been eating surely wood processed bread, and it's changed. And what? I mean, did you really believe that? Do you honestly think that's the case, or is it, I just think the man's gone mad?
It's a personal, it's a family trauma, though, isn't it? Because he's got an identical twin who got fat, and that's where this whole obsession started. Was like, where is, you know, what is he eating? We've got the same genetics. He's eating all this bread, and that's why we've ended up in this situation.
He got fat when he went to America. If you read the book, he got a bit fat. Not that fat. He got a bit fatter when he went to America. He's always liked his food. America has fantastically tasty food. But he also says in the book that he was extremely stressed because he'd got some woman pregnant on a one-night stand, which some people, if they were capable of a low blow, might say suggests a certain lack of self-discipline right there and then. But he was stressed about that and then overate in America where... Yeah, food is plentiful.
A lot of confounding things going on in that. Yeah,
I think within what stuff he's said and the stuff he's written, he still has quite a complicated relationship with food as well.
An unhealthy relationship with food, I would say. He says that he throws up. He used to regularly throw up. He'd eat so much and then he would throw up so he could eat more, I think he says. But certainly there's some sort of bulimic element to it. And he kind of says that very casually, like it's something that most people do.
We all want something to blame, don't we? Rather than sort of trying to understand our own complex relationship with food and our conservation with diet, we'd rather blame corporations are putting poison in our wholemeal bread. And that's why I had to throw up. It feels like that to me. And it really worries me because it's become such a popular thing and we're demonizing perfectly sensible food choices and we're making people feel really, really guilty about, you know, making perfectly sensible decisions about food for their families. And we're kind of guilt tripping people into spending a lot more time worrying and stressing about food and stressing about what they're going to eat and spending more time in the kitchen, you know, rather than just sort of relaxing and eating food, which is perfectly good. That's really distressing. I mean, anyone who's seen sort of people who do have complicated relationship with food and disordered relationship with food would know how damaging that can be. And also, you know, anyone who's just wants to feed their family in a sensible way and doesn't have an enormous amount of time to it, doesn't need a load of rich media doctors telling them that they're doing everything wrong by buying something which is actually absolutely fine. So yeah, I think we really need to sort of re-examine the way we're talking about food.
I think that's the perfect point to end the UPF section on. Chris, shall we turn to some of the other nanny state stories that you picked out to talk about this week? Top of the list, I would say, is the government now seems like they're going to follow many other countries in banning disposable vapes. It seemed like it was only a matter of time, but do you want to tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, they seem to have buckled to the pressure of banning disposable vapes, the Elf bars, the Lost Marys and so on, which have become very popular in the last two or three years, really. The number of adults who use them, the number of adult vapers who were on disposables has gone from 5% two or three years ago to about a third now. But amongst the underage users, it's about 65% or something. So it's the usual thing. I suppose you go, well, what are the people who shouldn't be buying vapes and aren't allowed to buy vapes? What are they vaping? We'll ban them and then there won't be any underage vaping. But as a young, I will not name names, but as a young person said to me only yesterday, they'll just buy refillable vapes. And if they can buy disposable vapes from a shop illegally, they can easily buy refillable vapes from a shop. So where will it end? Where will it end? We shall see what happens with this. They might change their mind. It's interesting that even Action on Smoking and Health, who are no stranger to a campaign to ban things, to say the least, they're actually against this. They say the unintended consequences are too great. And there are some pretty obvious unintended consequences. One is that some of these people, young people who are vaping illegally, might start smoking illegally instead. It's kind of, in a way, the nearest thing to a disposable vape is a cigarette. Certainly, there's a good chance that adult smokers who would otherwise vape will continue smoking, because good thing about these disposable vapes, they are very, very easy to use. You don't need to learn anything about wattage and atomizers and battery power and all the stuff that confuses people, particularly old people, I have to say, actually. And they're very cheap, which is quite good for people on low incomes who are looking to switch. So there are a range, as ever, a range of potentially negative consequences from doing that. I can sort of see why the government is doing it, because as I've said for quite a while on this podcast, before this even became an issue, teachers and parents have been concerned about this for quite a while, and it's finally come to a head, and we'll just see what happens. But I personally think the government should not be doing this.
It's also become a littering issue. So it's those kind of great, it's a great tabloid story as far as kids are doing this terrible thing and they're leaving it all over the place. So,
That's also illegal. Littering is illegal and selling vapes to kids is illegal. So let's enforce the law, shall we?
Let's lock those kids up.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of things can be dropped on the pavement and we don't ban them. In fact, there's no precedent, I don't think, at all for banning something just because it gets left on the ground. I guess in Singapore, they banned chewing gum for that reason, but chewing gum is particularly difficult to clean up, in fairness to the Singaporeans. Let's enforce the law. It's way too easy for kids to get vapes. It's not that easy for them to get cigarettes or vodka, so let's make it equally difficult.
But it is interesting, of all the things for teenagers to be hooked on, I think we should be counting our lucky stars that it's vaping. I mean, the previous sort of panics about them sniffing lighter fluid or glue or whatever, or actual drugs and things. And because also, I can't remember if we've spoken about any evidence on this front, but it does seem that it's not as if it is proving this gateway towards smoking. They are just vaping, it seems like, in large part, maybe not totally.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the danger is, as has happened in Australia, is that the government actually engineers a vapeway. A gateway.
That's quite a good coinage.
A gateway effect. There's never been a gateway anywhere in the world. Why would you switch to cigarettes, which are much more expensive and 100 times more dangerous? It doesn't happen. It's a sort of it's an old trope borrowed from the war on drugs. But in Australia, where they effectively got loads of kids hooked on on e-cigarettes by banning them completely and thereby making them very easily available because sellers don't care who they sell to, they then took them off the market almost completely, and it's the only country in the world where you've got rising rates of vaping underage and rising rates of smoking. And I'm not saying that will definitely happen in this country. I think it's quite possible that the teenagers who really like vaping will just buy refillables instead. But it's certainly not just a tail risk. There's quite a plausible sort of route by which you can see if kids genuinely can't get disposable vapes because they're not on the market for anyone, well, it's just still cigarettes.
Mm-hmm. And Anthony, what are your feelings about this particular ban? Have you noticed this explosion in vaping that the government seems to be concerned about?
No, but I wouldn't necessarily know. But I mean, I think it comes back to something we were talking about earlier. People don't like things for reasonably logical reasons and don't look at the kind of evidence behind it, but also like to demonize things that normal people like to do for pleasure. We kind of don't like things that people do for pleasure, even if it's better than, you know, even if it's getting people off smoking. So I obviously I'm not read all the evidence on vaping, but my understanding is it's far safer than smoking, and a huge number of people use, it's probably one of the most effective methods for smoking cessation. So we should really be supporting it. And if organizations like ASH are supporting it, then, you know, that definitely tells us something. I don't know. The specifics about the disposable vapes, I don't know. But the general campaign about vaping, I find, you know, sort of quite unsettling in its ferocity. And you wonder where it's what its origins really are. It just seems to be demonization of stuff that people like, in the same way that people demonize foods that people like.
And where has it come from, Chris, as the anti-vaping thing? Was it a public health-driven thing? Did a bunch of tobacco executives get together in a room, as they want to do, try and do something about it? Because it's everywhere as well. I mean, the UK has, if anything, been a bit of an outlier insofar as resisting these sorts of measures for a long time.
Yeah, oh, it has, absolutely, yeah. But like I say, Action on Smoking Health don't want to ban disposable vapes. I mean, even in Scotland, Action on Smoking Health want to ban disposable vapes, you know, let alone in America. So where has it come from? There are a whole load of people who've never liked the idea. They like the idea even less once the tobacco industry started making them. Because some of these people think it's more important to destroy the tobacco industry than to stop people smoking. You've got Mike Bloomberg putting in literally hundreds of millions of dollars towards pressure groups campaigning against vaping, effectively buying up the WHO. I saw a picture of Bloomberg with Tedros from WHO having a nice chat only this week. Bloomberg is literally paying for WHO operations and publications, and he's a fanatic against e-cigarettes. So that's where a lot of it's coming from, actually. But in this country, I think it has been a moral panic, probably is too extreme a word when you're dealing with something which is actually so widespread. It's very easy to exaggerate the number of underage vapors, but it has risen a great deal in the last 3 years, and almost entirely because of disposable vapes. So there have been, you know, there are legitimate concerns. I don't want to see, you know, 11, 12-year-old girls getting addicted to nicotine. Call me a killjoy moral Puritan. But it doesn't seem a great idea. You're absolutely right. It's better than taking drugs or smoking. But it seems to me something that can really be largely avoided through the enforcement of the existing laws.
What a crazy point. Chris, we're fast running out of time, but and I want to get to the postbags. There's a couple of questions for Anthony here about all questions food and diet. But do you want to tell us in like 2 minutes this story about nicotine-low cigarettes, a company selling nicotine-low cigarettes, which seems to be on the way out as a consequence of selling nicotine-low cigarettes. Do you want to tell us more about
that? Yeah, the company, it's American. It's called 22nd Century. They were the darlings of public health and briefly the darlings of the stock market. The FDA in America have a vague plan to take nearly all the nicotine out of cigarettes in an attempt to make them non-addictive. And they think this will make people stop smoking cigarettes, which it will. It'll stop buying legal cigarettes, at least, because what's the point? And so in order to try and get proof of concept, this company started making these very, very low nicotine cigarettes, virtually zero, really, and put them on the market. And surprise, surprise, nobody's buying them. In fact, nearly all the cigarettes they've made have been sold to various federal agencies for research purposes. I mean, tens of millions of cigarettes have been sold, but not to smokers, because unsurprisingly, people are not particularly interested in smoking what are essentially herbal cigarettes.
Just tar, no nicotine, or very little.
Yeah,
nicotine.
It's okay. It's the exact opposite of an e-cigarette, right? So the e-cigarette gives you the harmless but enjoyable thing that you want, that gets rid of the stuff that kills you. These do the opposite; they provide no benefits whatsoever, but can still kill you.
I don't want to dwell on this, but why did they promote this? Why was the FDA, whoever, really interested in this? It seems like a terrible idea, not just as a commercial prospect, but like it just seems like a bad idea.
It's a terrible idea that keeps coming up. Every 10 years or so, somebody in public health will say, you know what would be a cool idea is we take the nicotine out of cigarettes, then they won't be addicted, and then people find it easier to quit. And they traditionally have always been shouted down. People say, well, this is not going to work. But on this occasion, now that the public health groups have tried nearly everything and they're out of ideas, this incredibly poor idea has bubbled to the surface. And it's what they're doing in New Zealand. They've legislated for that in New Zealand. Everyone talks about New Zealand raising the age at which you can buy cigarettes, and that's their incremental prohibition. By far the more dramatic and immediate policy is taking the nicotine out of cigarettes. So we'll see how that goes down in New Zealand, but I suspect not too well.
definitely. We should keep an eye on it. Let's just very quickly go to our postbag section where listeners can send in their questions to Chris and our guests.
Postbag, postbag, postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
So, unsurprisingly, we've got a good few here which are around the questions of food fads and or questions about diets. We've got one question here which is about the phenomenon of intermittent fasting. So this gentleman here called JackCav99 says he wants to put to rest the idea of intermittent fasting once and for all. Isn't denial of food the perfect recipe for the body to store fat? So what do you think about his question, but also just the whole intermittent fasting thing more broadly?
Yeah, coming back to what I said before, people want a simple solution to what's often a complex problem. If you don't eat for 2 days out of seven, then you'll probably consume fewer calories in the short term. You'll probably lose some weight. The idea about intermittent fasting, though, is there's some sort of weird magic that happens and your body does some, and it's all nonsense. I mean, it's all. People see results because obviously you see results. Obviously, it's fairly evident that if you don't eat for long periods of time, then you'll probably not eat. You'll eat less over the long term. But your body has a remarkable capacity to readjust, and over the longer term, you'll probably put that weight back on. Intermittent fasting, in fact, works for some people. Do it, whatever. I'm not enormously bothered, but don't sort of pretend there's some sort of weird magic that happens and you're somehow biohacking your body and producing this sort of wonderful, lean, perfect physique out of that, because it's just, that's just nonsense, and that's designed to sell books and stuff. I mean, I don't know how you see books about fasting. I wonder what's in those books. don't eat on Tuesday.
Quite simple instruction, isn't it? I don't know how much detail you have to go into, but there's another question here, which I'm sure you both have thoughts on. But Anthony, just a question about essentially the levels of obesity and weight in the country. Why do you think there are so many very fat people in the UK? This gentleman, Pete J, suggests it's the big food companies who have hooked them on addictive, lousy food. So what do you make of that? What the scale of the problem, but also what the causes of it might be?
I've written a book, so I'd refer to that. So it's my book was kind of on that topic. It is complicated. The main reason, I think, is that we have a very safe, very secure and very cheap food supply, and very few people in the UK go hungry. If you go back 50, 60, 70, 80 years, lots of people weren't hungry on a regular basis and didn't have enough food to eat. Now we all have enough food to eat. And so, if you take a population and you feed all of them, a certain proportion will become overweight. And that's kind of where we are now. We're at where we would be if at any point in history we'd had such a safe and consistent food supply. I mean, the idea that the there's something weird in the food supply recently that's put everyone in this position, I don't think is true. There are things that happen, so some people have disordered relationships with food, but many people just have genetics which lead them to become overweight when food is abundant and available. And I think that's the main reason. There's a lot of complications around various individuals and people at the extremes of obesity. But what we do far too much is concentrate we should worry about people who are extremely obese, because there are obviously issues there which may be genetic, there may be disease, there may be there may be disordered relationships with food, and we should help those people and we should work with those people. What we shouldn't do is worry too much about people who are maybe BMIs of 26, 27 and have a consistent weight and a normal relationship with food, because what we do is pathologize that and put them into issues where they're being forced into diets and losing weight unnaturally, and that can cause eventual weight gain as well. So I think we just need to relax about it a bit more and help the people who are really struggling.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Chris? Any bold unifactorial theories you have about why we're in this?
Yes, people aren't smoking enough. There's not enough smokers, and constantly, people are
good appetite suppressant,
eating too much, and also not doing enough exercise. I wrote about this in my on my Substack a few months ago, but I found myself getting quite fat. I exceeded 13 stone for the first time in my life. And I realized this was because I had knackered both my knees. I bust both my menisci, which is in the middle of your knee, in a drunken dance floor mishap to the tune of Here I Go Again by Whitesnake at a wedding. And I basically couldn't really walk. I certainly didn't walk anywhere near as much as I had been doing. But I didn't change my diet. It didn't really occur to me. And before I knew it, I put on quite a bit of weight. And when I realized this and my knees got back to normal, I started doing my usual walk, which is not particularly vigorous, but, you know, usually do at least 2 or 3 miles a day, according to my phone. And would you believe it? A lot of that weight came off. Go figure.
Well, I thought all Henry Dimbleby and all these people told me that exercise makes a difference.
No, well, they're deluding themselves. I think they actually genuinely do believe that. You know, Chris Van Tulliken made a bit of a fool of himself on Twitter a few weeks ago by saying that the idea that physical activity burns calories is a myth created by Coca-Cola. he literally said that, you know.
That's crazy. I mean, this is conspiracy theory land, really, when you think about it. It's that dissimilar.
It is bonkers. It is bonkers. These things send people mad. You know, he can't be a stupid person. You know, he's an infectious disease doctor. He's gone through medical school. But the people can believe the most extraordinary things if they need to.
Well, there's always an open invitation to Chris Van Tulliken alongside.
I'm sure he's listening. Chris, get in touch. He's unfollowed me on Twitter, so maybe not.
No. We can set it up, definitely.
Yeah.
Ansi, before we let you leave, there's always one last question we always ask our guests, because this is a very libertarian podcast, and we're obviously generally against banning things. But we allow a space right at the end for our guests to say, if you had to ban one thing for very petty, personal, prejudicial reasons, can't be anything worthy like banning obesity or whatever, what would it be? To give you a flavour, Chris's favoured option is wheelie suitcases for some reason that you might go into. But yeah, if you had one ban, what would it be?
That'd get people exercising more by lifting suitcases up, is that?
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Right. What would I ban? I mean, you know, the boring answer for someone like me is just ban people making money out of diets and selling diets and dietary misinformation. You know, I'd be very strict on people.
That's too worthy. It needs to be something more petty.
Yeah, something like you walk out your house and you see someone across the street doing said thing or carrying said thing. You just think, that sort of, you know.
I am something of a grammar pedant, but I also am quite sort of pedantic about people getting expressions wrong. I think when people say things like "to all intensive purposes," that really annoys me. what's an intensive purpose and things like that I mean, just sort of petty sort of getting phrases wrong.
5 years in prison for that, just on the spot. It's the only way you can get rid of it.
The one that annoys me, and never used to until I started thinking about it, is when people talk about people shooting themselves in the foot when they make a balls up or something, when it's an accident. Whereas the whole point of shooting yourself in the foot is deliberate, to try and get out of the wall. And once I start thinking about that, I get infuriated every time I hear somebody use it incorrectly, which is 95% of the time. So can I ban that as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can.
I should get a ban as well every episode.
You could get one an episode, because you're quite a curmudgeonly character in some respects. I'm sure you've got enough material for us, but we'll start a board. But anyway, Anthony, thanks so much for your time, and I'll let you get back to your day.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.